I'm going to start off this morning. I'll start off this morning with a little poem by Kurt Vonnegut. He used the male-focused language of his era in this poem, but we can hear it as referring to everyone. Tiger got to hunt. Bird got to fly. Man got to sit and wonder why. Tiger got to sleep. Bird got to land. Man got to tell himself, he understand. Last week I suggested that most people think they know a lot more than they do about a wide range of topics. Today I'm going to expand on this theme, and I'm going to start with a personal story. The story is rather long, but it's such a fine illustration of self-deception. Many years ago, I enrolled in a well-known class, a course, in psychic healing. This course had trained thousands of people to go into a deep trance, and in that trance, to diagnose and heal physical illnesses. As the grand finale to the class, we divided up into groups of four and took turns diagnosing and healing disease. Each of us prepared by closing our eyes, going into this trance we'd been practicing, and then another student read us a card that listed the name, age, and city of some person none of us knew. The card also included the illness the person was suffering from. However, we didn't read that to the student in the trance. The student would attempt to identify the illness and heal it. We couldn't know whether healing had taken place, but we could verify for ourselves whether or not the person had gotten the diagnosis right. So the first student entered into a trance, and another student read the name, age, and place of residence to her. But my fellow students were not content to let this woman exercise her psychic powers. They gave her hints, even though our instructor had warned us not to do that. After they'd given her enough clues to know that the illness was a lung problem, she said, "I don't see any right lung." So another student then replied, "Well, now imagine yourself reaching into this person's chest and see which lung is missing." "Well, if she says there's no right lung, and they tell her to guess again, how many more lungs are there?" "Oh, yes, it's the left lung." "Very good." When the teacher came around and asked how the exercise was going, they replied, "We're all about 100% accurate." However, I did complain about all these hints, and they knew I was feeling like it wasn't quite going the way that I would ideally like it to see. So during a break, one fellow asked me to go through the process just with him. He promised not to offer any clues at all. So I agreed, but I secretly decided I would not go into the trance this time. I would simply rely on reason, because I thought that actually unconscious reasoning processes were what was allowing people to pick up on these hints. So when he said, "Now, Chris, look into this person's organs and bones," I tried to use my reasoning process and think, "Wait a minute, he specifically mentioned bones. Why was that, I wonder?" I think it's arthritis," I said. "Wow, that's right, Chris." I have become skeptical about ESP and other paranormal phenomena, but I admit that there is some controversial, highly debated evidence for these claims. We need skeptics about such matters, and we also need speculators. So I'm even skeptical of my own skepticism. Like Vonnegut's typical human, I sit and wonder why. But I try to not to tell myself I understand. I just don't think we know very much. This sermon series is called A Gospel of Ignorance, and gospel means good news. Last week I suggested that admitting the limits of our knowledge can empower us and even inspire us in two ways. It can foster a healthy humility, and it can fill us with an awe that is deeply spiritual. Some of my examples last week had to do with economic and political issues, in which we seem to be ignorant. And because these are crisis times, I'm going to say more today about these topics. And then I'll elaborate further on the idea that facing ignorance can be a kind of gospel. As you know, some of the political changes sweeping our country are striking terrible blows against Unitarian Universalist values. And because many of these changes are shocking and unexpected, this is an opportunity to realize that we did not understand our fellow citizens as well as we thought. It's hard to just be with our perplexity, experiencing bafflement, until new insights come to us. I know we'll learn crucial lessons from this mess. I just wish the lessons would come more quickly. One thing I'm glad of is that when I first saw Donald Trump in the Republican presidential candidate debates about 10 years ago, I made a commitment that I would never try to figure this guy out. He earnestly, so sincerely, from his heart, proclaimed so many obvious falsehoods and cheerfully contradicted himself so many times, I figured there was no way to know what he really thinks. And hundreds of times since then, I've heard commentators inform us about why Trump said or did something bizarre. Pundits are still pounding on how stupid he is, or how childish, or how easy he is to manipulate, or how unhappy he is deep inside, making him sound rather pitiful while he takes over the world. My decision not to diagnose Donald goes along with my general skepticism about our ability to understand people's motives. Anyone who works as a psychotherapist will find out before long that there are tons of examples of people just completely misunderstanding each other, even though they've known each other for years. Most of us have a lot to do also in learning to understand ourselves. Okay. In fact, just last week I read an academic paper that mentioned the mountain of empirical evidence showing that our explanations as to why we acted are extremely unreliable. If I can't even understand myself, how am I going to understand Donald Trump? And how are the pundits doing at explaining why Kamala Harris lost? I'm going to quote an outstanding political blogger named Doug Mutter. How many of you follow Doug Mutter's blog? I'm glad to see at least a couple or three or four of you are following his blog. He's a Unitarian Universalist, and he's so well-researched and thinks things through so clearly. I'm very impressed with him. His blog is called The Weekly Sift, Sifting the News a Week at a Time, The Weekly Sift. So recently, he commented on an article by Nathan Heller in The New Yorker. He writes, "Heller begins with an observation I keep banging my head against. All those accounts where Harris lost because she didn't do something, almost invariably she did do the things they're claiming she didn't do. She talked about kitchen table issues. She had detailed policy proposals. She gave interviews. She reached out to every kind of voter. She raised money. She advertised. She had a great ground game. But for some reason, the things she did and said didn't register with some large chunk of the electorate. For some reason." As I've been talking about perplexities about Trump and American voters, have your own theories been popping into your mind? You may have found yourself thinking, but Chris, that is the problem, don't you see? Well, whatever your theory is, I'm not saying it's wrong. However, notice if it pops up automatically as a reaction to somebody else's idea or as a reaction to my skepticism about what we know. Now, if we want to make progress in fiction-proofing our minds, one way to do that is to recognize our own biases, to recognize when we're rigidly attached to some opinion. For example, when you heard about global warming decades ago, did you immediately assume it was a big problem? Or did you immediately assume that environmental extremists were being hysterical? Either assumption reveals a bias, because at first this idea was controversial. Then how did you react as a scientific consensus developed that human activity is heating up the planet? And then what did you think when scandalous emails were discovered that suggested that some scientists were exaggerating the data about global warming? Then later, it looked as if this attempt to cheat on the data was really rather insignificant. And of course, now the case for warming is overwhelming. Did you revisit your opinions, kind of think, well, I wonder about this, in each case, as new data emerged? So we can identify our biases and resist the temptation to automatically believe whatever confirms our opinions. Now here's another very human mistake. Our brains are constantly discovering patterns, including patterns that aren't there. Sometimes that can make us actually turn the exception into the rule. I heard of a high school principal who was always talking about how baseball players were good students, and he always mentioned two straight-A students who were star pitchers. Well, somebody looked back through the class records and found that the baseball players had the same pattern of grades as everyone else, with two exceptions. The two star players, the two star pitchers, the principal loved to talk about. Okay, so notice here, the two students had been unusual. Being unusual, they stood out. Since they stood out, he paid attention to them. Since he was focusing attention on them, he came to believe they were typical. What a paradox. When we see something unusual, it may stand out and seem to be typical. Another pitfall is the unconscious belief that everything is about me, taking things personally when we should not. Aspiring physicians often develop medical school syndrome. As soon as they read about some ghastly, incurable, agonizing, and fatal illness, they're sure they've got it. In astrology, I read about the typical Pisces, and I see myself. But suppose you and I sat down and wrote up a little personality profile using vague and general descriptions that could fit almost anyone. Then we could tell somebody, here are the results of your psychological tests. Or, this is the way you are because you're a Capricorn. Do you think they'd buy it? Actually, we know they probably would. Let me read you a passage from a standard psychological testing handbook or textbook. It is a relatively easy task to prepare a pseudo-report from general stereotypical statements that apply to most people. A considerable body of research has demonstrated that such reports are readily accepted as remarkably accurate self-descriptions by a large majority of people. Another problem is that people often make amazing mistakes either in observation or in interpreting what they see. Of course, people do vary enormously in their powers of observation and their abilities to interpret, as is illustrated in this story of the time Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson went on a camping trip. Middle of the night, Holmes wakes up and gives Dr. Watson a nudge. Watson, he says, look up, tell me what you see. I see millions of stars, Holmes. And what do you conclude from that, Watson? Well, astronomically, it tells me that there are millions of galaxies and potentially billions of planets. Astrologically, I observe that Saturn is in Leo. Horologically, I deduce that the time is approximately 3:15. And Watson, as you look up at all those stars, what else does that suggest?
Well, theologically, it tells me that God is all-powerful and we are small and insignificant. What does it tell you, Holmes?
Watson, you idiot. Someone has stolen our tent.
Here's a real-life example of a mistaken observations and interpretations. One day, a Professor Mendoza appeared on Spanish television claiming that he could start watches and bend kitchen utensils, such as spoons, at a distance of many kilometers. Thousands of people called the station, verifying that their timepieces were restarting and their cutlery had begun to bend. Professor Mendoza then revealed that he was actually the president of Spain's Magicians Society and was relying on the power of suggestion rather than psychic power. No doubt lots of people have some bent forks and spoons lying around. After Mendoza predicted that bending would occur, they paid attention to distortions in silverware they hadn't noticed before. And when we move a stopped timepiece, might jiggle it enough so that it starts ticking. But people may have overlooked that fact when they picked up an old watch and discovered it was actually running. So we turn the exception into the rule, we take things personally when they have nothing to do with us, and we make important mistakes in observation or interpretation. Here's another idea about the value of admitting ignorance. Where there is ignorance, there is potential. It may seem as if our personal problems have no solutions, or that the evils of society cannot be corrected. But because our knowledge is so limited, we no doubt overlook all sorts of alternatives. Life is abundant with possibilities. I am an agnostic about human progress. I do not think we know enough to know whether the world is getting better or getting worse. No human mind is powerful enough to add up all the positive and negative trends and determine whether the world as a whole is improving or deteriorating. Admitting ignorance is also good because it reminds us that we need each other's special perspective. Imagine that this room here is a great valley, and we are all standing in a huge circle around this valley. From over there, you can see things that I cannot see from my perspective, and I can see things that you can't. So I like to think of each person as staffing a lookout post, seeing the world from a particular angle. Being open-minded does not mean abandoning your own perspective. You are responsible for staffing your post faithfully, accurately reporting what you see from your own vantage point in life and in the world. But you can also listen to reports from other posts and occasionally visit their platforms to see what they're observing at that time. We need each other. Conservatives need liberals, and liberals need conservatives, at least to keep each other somewhat honest. And as I've said here more than once, I even think those who believe in God need those who do not, and that atheists need theists. The ones we don't need, in my opinion, are authoritarian politicians and theocratic religionists. They need to stop being bullies and act like truly patriotic Americans. And one more thing. Admitting ignorance keeps us growing. We are the creatures that can always learn more. To paraphrase Vonnegut's poem, tiger knows how to hunt, bird knows how to fly. We know there's always one more. Why?
I'm so proud that you used are known for that bumper sticker that says, to question is the answer. We are learning to rest in our restless curiosity. Tiger got to sleep. Bird got to land. We can accept there's always more than we can understand.